Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, the only source for Nintendo news on the internet. I am your host, James Jones. And I am joined today by Mr. John Lindemann.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you, John. John, I've got some trivia for you.
Okay.
I'm going to read you a list of three developer names. One of them is real and published a game on the Super Nintendo in Japan. I want you to tell me which is the real company.
All right, go ahead.
Pineapples, Japan. Durians, Japan, or Coconuts, Japan.
Durians, Japan?
No, I'm afraid it's Coconuts, Japan. They are responsible. Yeah, wow. They I don't know how I ended up on this chain of looking at very strange games. But they are responsible for, amongst other things, the Lawnmower Man for Super Nintendo.
Huh. For whatever, well, no, actually, I know exactly the reason. I was really interested in that game because I kind of liked the movie, because I guess the virtual reality stuff was cool. And also there was like 3D segments or something in the screenshots that I saw in magazines. And then I, you know, eventually I got the ROM and I played it and I was like, it's garbage. Oops.
Yeah, it's I'm sure it's terrible. Like, I mean, I wouldn't expect anything else from a Lawnmower Man-based video game. So, yeah. You know. It is what it is. You're also hearing Mr. Guillaume Vallette.
The movie that Stephen King sued to have them stop putting his name in front of the title because it had nothing to do with the short story he wrote.
The short story is really weird.
Right. It's about like some fawn that, I don't know, something. It's nothing to do with Jaffe. So. Mm-hmm.
Guillaume, I have the same question for you.
Okay.
These are also Japanese developers, or one of them is. Kurisumasu, which would be the Japanese word for Christmas. Barentine's Day, which you could probably guess what that one is. Or Basuday. Not the Japanese doesn't have its own word for birthday.
But
they also borrowed ours.
So the real one, I think, would be Christmas?
No, unfortunately, it's birthday. They are developers of Crystal Beans from Dungeon Explorer.
That would have been my beans. Guess, for the record.
Crystal Beans.
Crystal Beans. Basuday! That's
what it was. Basuday!
I'm impressed. Instead of going the easy route of just having to invent one fake company for your trivia, you invented two fake names.
Yeah, well, you know, that's you know, I put some work into this. I did some research over the week for this stupid idea. Finally, we're joined by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Greg, same question.
Okay.
Amphitheater. Concert hall or opera house?
I'm going to go with amphitheater.
I'm afraid it's opera house. Developers of game Classic Road and Classic Road 2.
I should have, no, I think it was, did you put the real one third every time?
Nope.
Oh, it was twice, so then, yeah.
Twice, and then Coconuts Japan was first. I skipped Diamond Party, Ruby Party, and then another party I'm not going to name because that was really inappropriate.
Mario Party?
Yep, that's what I'm talking about.
Yep,
okay. And then my other one was Leland Interactive Media. I couldn't figure out how to make three names to go with that.
Other members of the Palmer family in Twin Peaks.
There you go.
Sarah, Laura.
I found a lot of really dumb developers, like Blastdoor Software. Nope, Bulletproof Software. It's all kinds of fun developers out there in this research for a project that I'm not ready to talk about yet, so we're not going to, but I figured some trivia to start the show might get the juices going early because it's time for new...
You just talked about the project, but whatever.
I didn't say what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First off, fuck you, John. Now you're going second. Mm-hmm. John just got slid to second. You can't stop this. I have the sheet in front of me. Guillaume.
Yeah?
Would you care to talk about some Mega Man demos?
Sure. Not that much to say. I played it like an hour before we started the recording, and I discovered that I'm really, really bad at Mega Man 11. I actually think, and I know this sounds like a cop-out, but I actually think that there's something wrong with my Joy-Cons because I've had some issues, and I didn't think that I could develop like a poor... Is it the left, you know, stick that kind of... The left Joy-Con that stops working? Or
yeah, it's the one that manages motion in most cases.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, like, I've started the... It started giving me trouble recently, so...
Yeah, me too. It can be really quite inopportune in a game of Mario Tennis.
Hmm.
Wait, Jack,
just I can see that being an issue.
I am lined up to cuff this return right back, and now I've walked away. I look like I'm hot dogging it and throwing the match at the same time. It's embarrassing.
You know, you should. I actually fully agree with the decision to hot dog it, though. I think that's the right way to...
Hot dog throw in the match.
Yeah. I think...
it's an interesting notion.
It's performance art, you see. Like, hey. you're playing with their expectations. It's like The Last Jedi. You're subverting expectations. That's how you know it's good. All right. Well, anyway, Guillaume, tell us about Mega Man 11.
I have no idea what's going on, and I have to... No, I don't think Urban Dictionary that I was looking for hot dog down the hallway.
Yes, anyway. That's what Greg was talking about, yes.
Yep.
Anyway. Where was I? Yeah, so I'm pretty bad at this. Part of it is, I think, my Joy-Con. But I was doing a little bit better using, you know, playing on the TV, using the Pro Controller. But not that much better. So definitely there's definitely some rustiness involved. And before we started recording, Greg was wondering if there was a better way to say, you know, that you've lost skills when you've never had any in the first place. Because rusty implies that, like, oh yeah, I used to be good at this. Now I'm not.
I've oxidized.
Right. So here, yeah. So dusty was suggested by James. But so I am a little bit dusty.
Aren't we all?
So, yeah, imagine a not particularly valuable object that's also been very much neglected over the years and declined, depreciated in value further. That's really what I want.
These Mega Man muscles have never been flexed, or very little, you know. Anyway, so...
You can't atrophy what's not there.
Yeah, and of course we've had our retroactive about Mega Man...
Three?
But yeah. I ended up playing, like, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. Like, I just, like, went on a Mega Man Rampage. But, of course, I was playing on the 3DS with save states, which I now realize is the only reason why I made it through,
five,
6 games.
With the well-known good D-pad, right, John?
Yeah. Also, yes. So the game is pretty hard. You do, like, there is this gear system that you can activate temporarily. You can slow down time, or you can boost your shots, or you can do both at the same time. And but then, like, when you do that by pressing the two shoulder buttons at the same time, then you can't stop it. Like, it just, like, it's kind of a, you know, you become overpowered for a bit, and then you become underpowered until the gauge recharges. Apparently I should have been using that more than I have been, but even if I had, like, some of the bits that gave me the most trouble were actually platforming bits. And there's a lot of sections where you've got conveyor belts, and you've got these giant blocks that fall regularly and predictably from the ceiling. But for some reason, that combined with the fact that there's these slow-moving enemies that float towards you at all times coming out, and you kill them and they come back, and, you know, like, they always seem to be right above you when you have to jump. Like, that just threw me off all the time, and I had a really hard time adjusting. And eventually I swallowed my pride, and I went back to the, you know, I had a game over, I went back to the menu, I started a game on casual difficulty, which gives you 5 lives and also gets rid of some of the enemies. So it's some of the more, like, maddeningly placed enemies. And turns out that's what I needed. And the description for the casual difficulty is literally, like, for those who love Mega Man but haven't played in a while, and that's me. So I should have been playing that from the start.
I mentioned this when we were promoting the interview that I talked about months ago. We finally went live a couple weeks ago. And one of the things I mentioned in it is, like, really freaking use the gear system, because it came up during the interview. Like, a lot of the stuff in these stages in particular was, like, designed with the idea that the gear system is there.
Yeah, I agree with that, just from what I've played in the demo so far. On the normal setting, it does seem like it. You know, not necessarily that it's impossible to do, you know, to succeed without it.
Oh, no,
it,
it's
but
not.
There's things that we, like Gil mentioned, the conveyors and stuff. Like, imagine you've got, you know, an enemy on the conveyor, so it's coming towards you, so you've got like a pretty tight window of time to kill it, and it's a bit of a damage sponge type of thing. It's really kind of pushing you to think, slow down time, and then I've got more time to kill this thing. You know, I think it's trying to not only, you know, kind of you know, show how it can be used, but actually prod you to use it. You know, so in this, which is sensible in a demo. It's a single stage that I've seen so far, the Blockman stage, which I'm sure people have seen video of from E3. But you know, it's nice to see it actually on the system, and it looks nice, runs nicely too, as far as I could tell so far.
Yeah, I didn't have any issues playing it, you know, in terms of performance, playing it on the in handheld mode or on the TV. It looks quite nice. I'm not in love with the music. It's kind of a non-entity. Like, I could have the game muted and wouldn't make a difference, and that's a shame because, you know, Mega Man music usually is so catchy and so classic.
Much like I do right now.
I do use the gear system to slow down time, especially like for those enemies that are in a wheel and there's like one open spot in the wheel and that's the only time that you can hit them, and so, you know, like it makes sense, like, okay, slow down time, just kill them and then stop the using the gear, and then
they do give you two kind of weapons that you presumably in the full game you would get from defeating robot masters. And like, you know, they're sort of an alternative way of dealing, like for instance with those enemies, the shock blaster seems to be pretty good at getting them because it's just got a big area of effect on it. So, you know, it's not like, again, you were like completely funneled into using the gears, but I think he's trying to encourage you to do it. Yeah, with not just like the layouts, but yeah, even the enemy design in that case.
Right. And you know, you can also combine, you know, a special weapon and the gear system, and it has a different effect, I think, depending on the weapon that you're using. There's some stuff to experiment with, so that's interesting. But yeah, so I did manage to beat the demo in the end. The boss fight was kind of surprising. I had been watching the videos, so, you know, there's multiple stages to it, it was pretty challenging. But yeah, like I guess I'm just mostly kind of wondering, like, what the hell's wrong with me that I died so many times playing this game. And maybe also it kind of suffers in comparison to Dead Cells, which is like my obsession of the moment. And in that game, it's kind of the jumping is so different, you know. Like,
yeah, that is something that will hurt. If you're in the groove of one game and then you play another one that's similar but different, and then you've like, you kind of, without knowing it, you're instinctively doing things that are, you know, where, you know, it just is not working that way. And sometimes if it's subtle enough, you're not even aware that you're kind of, you know, your expectations are sort of being confounded because you're just thinking of some other game or something. Especially like if it's like games in the same series that are subtly different or something, I find you gotta like unlearn some things before you could get it. Oh, there was that Christmas I played Metroid Prime and Time Splitters too. Getting my head around what to do with the seat, reprogramming my right hand to deal with the C-stick for each game was fun.
In Dead Cells, like the character is so fast and just like automatically climbs up a platform that you jump to, you know, and it's just fast, it's automatic, and then playing Mega Man in comparison, it feels very stiff, but it is mostly like Mega Man physics. Like, it's not if they were going for the gameplay of Mega Man, like, it makes sense. It's just that I'm kind of used to a differently controlled character. So yeah, so basically my new business was all me making excuses for being so bad at Mega Man. I'm not sure, you know, it's $40 here in Canada. I'm not sure if I want it. I'm not sure if I'm going to buy it because there are so many like indie 2D platformer games that came out just like in the last month, in the last week on the Switch. So many things to catch up with that it's kind of a $40 Mega Man is kind of a tough sell. Like I picked up Hollow Knight during the sale a couple of weeks ago, haven't started that. Like it just
a substantial game,
right? Yeah, it's like it's a 30-hour game, or you know. So,
and I mean, Dead Cells is half that price, right? Dead Cells is $20,
right? And I'm still not done with that. Like I got very far into it. I think it felt like I got very far, and I got to kind of a castle area, and what's the name of the tune? Vampire Killer. A complete ripoff of Vampire Killer is playing in that stage, and I was like, oh yeah, that's awesome. There's also, you know, and also before that, like I unlocked Valmont's Whip, which is you know, kind of a it's a weapon that's very Castlevania-ish, and I don't think it's a reference to Dangerous Liaisons or whatever. Like I think this
that
is
you know of.
Right, I don't remember any whipping in that book or in the movie, so it has to be a Castlevania reference. Yeah. Anyway, I'm rambling here, but I just I don't know. Like, I think that people probably already know if they're buying this game or not, especially if they've played the same demo I have. So, I personally think I might skip it.
Yeah, I mean this is going to be one of those, like, you will know if this game is for you basically by the time you complete this demo.
Yeah.
I'm surprised a little bit that it's only one stage demo, because there were three stages at PAX West. Hmm. There were two at E3, although there was only one playable on the floor.
It makes sense because you don't want to give away a third of the full game, right?
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, I would think maybe like one other thing in there, because there's other stuff just to give you the opportunity to see, maybe not even play the full stage in any of them, just like make it so there's just something else you can see,
right?
Because it's not called Blockman. I can't remember what he's called. His stage isn't that visually interesting.
Hmm. What is the name of the weapon? I thought it was kind of it's a stupid sounding weapon name.
It's a Mega Man weapon,
right? Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised it's the same thing, but I your point's well founded. Like, you wouldn't want to give away too much of the game for free. I don't know. It's neat that we got a demo. Because I think I personally love this demo, and I'm playing it yet again. For some reason, even though I've already beaten it multiple times, but
block dropper. Yeah, speaking of Urban Dictionary, anyway,
don't look that one up.
No.
What I was really surprised about in the game when I played it originally, and then I was surprised about it again just now, is how much this game fetishizes short hops. And by that I mean, like, there's more than one place where if you do a full jump, Mega Man hits his head and you die. Enjoy your short hops, kids. Woo! So if you find that's happening a lot, it's probably one of those.
Hmm. I'm not sure I know which places you're referring to. So maybe I got around certain areas in a different way. I did use a rush coil quite a bit.
You can definitely skip a few bits, like slow down time, jump on a block, then activate rush, then hop up somewhere. You know, like the gear system and the slowing down time thing gives you some flexibility. And the fact that rush is mapped just to a single button rather than having to scroll through special weapons to get to him is a lot nicer too, and you know, especially in those time sensitive situations.
Yeah, especially when you need to shoot at an enemy right afterwards. Like, you don't have to cycle back to your normal weapon, right? Like, that was always kind of a sticking point.
Yeah.
Using Rush in the past games.
Yeah. Cool. All right, John, your suspension is over. You've served 1/4 suspension for your, we'll call it undisclosed team policy violation.
This is fine. I regret my actions, and I accepted my sentence.
In the old days, we called it key shunning.
Nice.
All right, so I picked up Disney Afternoon Collection, and I've been playing some DuckTales.
Speaking of Capcom platformers.
Yeah, exactly, and it's funny, Guillaume just saying, "Yeah, this game is hard." Well, DuckTales. Also a hard game. I've been making quite the use of save states. Not really because I can't actually do what the game is asking me to do, but the game is extremely punishing in the sense that it starts you right back at the start of any area that you're in for pretty much anything that you do. So you start off and you have 5 kind of worlds that you can dive into. And your goal is, I believe, to get an artifact from each of these 5 worlds. And then I'm assuming there's probably a 6th world that opens up after that, and you have to beat the end boss.
Basically tomb robbing.
The big bad. Yes, yes. And, in the guise of a side-scrolling platformer. Not entirely side-scrolling. You're also going up, down, whatever, climbing up ropes. And, your typical kind of 8-bit, platformer kind of stuff. And you control Scrooge McDuck, and in certain levels you have to find Huey, Dewey, and Louie, or do whatever the other DuckTales characters. I mean, I'm not really up on my DuckTale lore, so I can't tell you how much of it is canon or what characters are and aren't. I mean, I haven't watched that show in, it seems like, 1,000 years.
The 1,000-year reign of Scrooge McDuck.
The 1,000-year reign of Scrooge McDuck, indeed. So, but it's a difficult game. The controls are pretty hard to grasp right off the bat because your main attack is Scrooge McDuck using his cane like a pogo stick, which is, and you jump up in the air and then hold down and B, which is incredibly strange. You get used to it and you become actually pretty adept at it once you kind of work out the physics involved. But when I first started playing the game, that was such a weird attack because you can also walk up to something and kind of golf club it if you just walk up and hit B. And I thought that originally that was the original attack, and then I was just getting killed a bunch of times, and I'm like, oh, okay. No, I didn't read the manual. I just started playing because who does that? Who does that, really?
No, nobody does.
So, yeah, so that's how I figured out the whole
thing. Did you read manuals from the late 80s, early 90s? They're not legible.
No, nobody did. Nobody ever did.
Nobody could.
But yeah, that's how
literally in my case, a lot of them were in Japanese.
Guess what, Greg? A lot of them were in English. They still weren't readable.
Cool artwork, though.
That's true.
Or they just didn't have a lot of information that you actually required.
Or they gave you the plot that the localization team just fucking made up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there wasn't any.
Yep. So once I got that, once I got around to figuring that out, actually how to kill enemies, it actually became pretty fun, difficulty aside. What I like about it is the fact that it has a couple of those, stuff like fake walls that you can walk through and stuff like that, almost Castlevania-like to a degree. Sort of, there's always like kind of like goodies you can, and you get, jewels and diamonds that you can uncover by jumping up in the air and hitting B, at a certain spot kind of thing, and a diamond will appear. So there's a lot of kind of hidden stuff like that, but just in classic NES style, it's kind of hard to, it's sometimes hard to figure out exactly where that stuff is if they give you hints. Like, the hints are very much like you walk up to Huey and he says, "Hey, Scrooge McDuck, this area has illusory wall." And it's like, oh, okay, illusory wall? What does that mean exactly? Oh, okay, it's apparently, I guess it's a wall you can walk through.
It means the illusion of a wall?
Yeah, it's just weird. Some strange phrasing. And then there's also, And I know in the there's the Transylvania level, there's mirrors that you can go through, but you're not really kind of, they aren't really explained to you. They're just there. And that's very typical of NES platformers, where if there's anything that is outside the norm, or if they try anything outside of just you literally running through killing enemies, it kind of gets weird. You kind of have to figure things out for yourself. Classic example of this, I always think of Mylon Secret Castle. There is stuff in that game that is just completely unexplained to you.
You mean the game?
Yeah, yes, in the game. Stuff.
No,
no,
I mean the game. The game
the
is unexplained
guy.
To you.
All of it.
The totality of Mylon's Secret Castle, including your objective, is not explained.
Exactly. Yes, that it is the most extreme example of that. And DuckTales has a little bit of that, so it was interesting playing an NES game where I'm like, oh yes, I remember NES games like this, where they were difficult and some stuff just wasn't explained to you. So not only did you get your butt kicked by the game, but then there was sometimes you would hit a brick wall just because, for example, in the Amazon level, there's this one area where one of the DuckTales characters flies by in a plane, but yet there's no real obvious way to actually catch the rope that he's dangling so he can pull you across the crevasse that's right there, right? But what I figured out is that you have to actually jump up and press up and B, I think it is. But that's not explained to you at all. Like, this character just appears. He's flying around, and somehow, and you do it sometimes, and then you die, and you don't really know how you did it, so you just keep doing it, dying a bunch more times, then eventually you figure out exactly how to do it every single time, and then you keep going. So that's pretty much... That's kind of like DuckTales, so...
I gotta say, like, I did not remember the controls being that finicky when I played it on the Game Boy when I was a kid. That's the version I played the most. And then, yeah, like, I went back, like, played a ROM or something, and just I was like, how is this so kind of unplayable?
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because DuckTales Remastered has an option in the options to toggle on or off like the bad controls. Like, you can have the original controls, or you can have better controls that make the pogo stick and other stuff like that much easier to pull off. So anyway.
Yeah, what are the better controls?
Because the pogo stick, you know, instead of like, so you start it by holding down and B, and like when you jump. But if you turn on the easier controls, I think you can let go of down once you've started, you know.
Yeah.
You won't, so, you don't pogo cancel.
Right. You just hold down the is it the attack button that you're holding down? It's kind of counterintuitive.
Yes.
But yeah, so yep. You hold down the, and he stays and you know, he's still doing the pogo thing.
Yep. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, it's good. It's pretty cool. In the sense that, you know, there's a lot of hidden areas, and it has the that kind of, you know, you can climb up to the top of the screen kind of and run along in the scoreboard kind of thing to find, and then drop down into hidden areas. You can do some of that too. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of room to explore. So it's good. It's good. But,
and this
but, yeah.
is like the last Capcom collection that isn't on Switch, right? It's it still hasn't happened yet with all the ones that have come over, but I assume licensing makes it more complicated.
It just feels like Disney has something against Nintendo. They give us maybe like the Lego games and with like the Incredibles game, but so this is not coming out on Switch.
They'd have to do another deal, wouldn't they?
Probably.
It'd be one thing if you're starting from scratch when, you know, with the licensing when Switch is a thing, you know, and they know how popular it is and all that, and that contingency is already accounted for. I guess it's a different thing when a deal was made at such a point when it wasn't accounted for, and then it's a question of revisiting that and doing whatever it would take to, you know, then at some point seemingly it's not as worth the trouble, or at least you know, not to do it that expeditiously.
I guess so, but like Pinball FX3, the Star Wars tables have not come out on Switch.
They were on Wii U and 3DS, so it's not really a Nintendo thing. Like,
they just existed when that deal got signed.
Right. Well, maybe the fact that they were in Wii U explains why they're not on Switch. Like maybe they got burned. Yeah, and like there's like three, I think, solo tables that came out recently-ish, and those haven't come out on the Switch either. So even the newer movies are not represented in Pinball FX 3 on Switch. So I don't know. I've decided that, yeah, Disney's at fault.
Probably.
They have to be. Yeah. They just hate me.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, personally.
Always personal. It's always personal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean they say what systems does Guillaume Vayette own? And then they accidentally released one that's on a system you do own, and now they're very, very intent to not let that happen again.
Yeah.
In fact, secretly they actually released that game for I can't tell you that. I'm sorry.
I was thinking if we were thinking about it logically, it would be more pertinent for movie taglines to point out when it wasn't personal.
But this time it's impersonal.
Yeah,
this time it's completely dispassionate.
Yeah. This time it's objective.
This time it's just misfortune.
That's just not the way that taglines work, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know.
This time it's a very odd coincidence.
It just reminds me of the Simpsons episode where he's fighting the Mike Tyson stand-in. It's like payback.
Yes.
Never fought before. Just die.
You were talking about illusory walls earlier.
Yeah, illusory walls.
And yeah. I wanted to know why Jim Caldwell was in this game.
Jim Caldwell. Has he ever smiled?
Has he ever moved?
Yeah, I know.
It's football jokes for the start of the football season.
Yeah, football jokes.
More of these are coming.
That fourth and two against the Patriots all those years ago. I would have smiled if I was Caldwell.
That would require a central nervous system.
Yeah. So, anyways, yeah, DuckTales. So, DuckTales 2 is in there. Tailspin, Darkwing Duck, Chippendale Rescue Rangers, and Chippendale Rescue Rangers 2 are also there. So, I'll be probably dipping into quite a bit of Disney. But, yeah, it's also interesting, too. I must say, it's sort of nice how brief this game is. It's just nice saying, like, oh, well, I've only thrown a few hours at it, and I'm probably halfway through this game right now. But yeah.
And I have finished it.
Yeah. Those were the days.
Nice. All right, Greg.
Yep. So first of all, before I get on to sort of picking up where I left off with the messenger last week, there's something apparently I need to address. As we all know, the war on fact rages on.
Oh,
and,
God.
This is probably the most important front in that struggle that I'm about to address. So, yeah, I was just checking the resetterer, I guess is the way to pronounce it.
Mm-hmm. I don't encourage it.
For our podcast. And somebody, I believe, Hercule.
Not with four pages.
Possibly a detective, we don't know. was asking the question about why I bought the 3DS version of X Troopers and not the PS3 version, to which Donald and James suggested it's because I don't own a PS3, which is in fact false. I do.
Oh, good.
I still own a PS3.
I'm trying to keep you from getting robbed, sir.
Yes, those hot PS3s.
I'm lying about your material possessions. I'm not going to tell them about the gold bullion you've got hidden.
It's the the hot item that all robbers are after these days. No, it's I guess I didn't talk about PS3 stuff that much.
You're right, you do have one.
But I did have one. I spoke about, some prominent games of the day, games that were on other formats, of course, but didn't have a 360 until you guys kindly gifted me one. So, stuff like when I spoke about the Arkham games or like Dead Space, or that was on PS3. And some of the retro stuff, quite a bit of retro stuff I got through with PS3.
In my brain, I transposed PS3 to PS4, which...
Yeah, that's true. I don't have a PS4, but... That brings us kind of round to some of how
I bought a PS4.
I didn't know. That brings us round to the actual answer to Hercule's question about the X Troopers thing. So X Troopers came out at the end of 2012. For me, it's kind of late PS3 territory. Your generously gifted Xbox 360 had arrived then, so I kind of had to, the PS3 was split in time at the TV with the 360, so I haven't got that many HDMI ports, so wasn't getting used that much then. And yeah, at that point it was like, well, let's see if there might be any hope for a localization at some point on either system, and you know, it was kind of expensive to buy it at that point. And then as time went on, eventually I got an Xbox One. PS3 isn't connected to the TV at all. It's just, you know, even though I'm sure it's the better version of the game in many respects, it's just that it's more convenient and handheld. I'm not going to dig the PS3 out and unplug the Xbox or the Switch or whatever to accommodate that, just to play X Troopers, and it was really cheap in that 3DS sale. So that's how it came to be. But I'm a little hurt that my PS3 insights were so easily forgotten in the past like eight years.
My deep condolences.
And now you know the rest of the story.
I'll go play the Virtual Boy and give another retrospective on it for penance. That's roughly the equivalent of self-flagellation.
Yeah, well, I guess, does flagellation give you headaches?
I mean, if you miss.
But yeah, we're going to get back onto the messenger now. And yeah, with this, again, so last week I kind of didn't want to get into specifics. This week, yeah, I'm pretty much going to have to. I've seen, as far as I could tell, 100%ed the game. There's nothing else to it. I don't know whether there'll be any kind of expansions or anything at any point. There is, at least I've seen on Steam, there's like DLC songs by the Ninja Gaiden composer. So that's cool. I don't know, but other than that, I don't know that there's going to be like further like actual level content for the game. But so to get into kind of the what we talked about last week, the two phases of the game. So it's not really a question of the 8-bit, 16-bit of the two as being the two phases of the game that I was referring to last week. It's the linear versus non-linear. So you kind of have a, you know, linear section to the game, you kind of reach that end, and then it opens up into, you know, a more kind of exploration based kind of affair, and that's really kind of the second half of the game. And it's an interesting situation because you've got what were kind of linear levels that you played through being revisited in a non-linear fashion. You've got some new kind of sections opening up that, you know, you never played through in the sort of fully linear fashion before. So they have a, you know, slightly different kind of level design paradigm. Although it's worth noting that even the first time through playing some of these levels, you'll see things that seem suspicious, like, you know, that you kind of feel like you're going to come back to. So clearly, you know, all the levels are designed with it in mind to some extent, but there's a, you know, presumably, yeah, the nature of it means that it had to be prioritized to work as a linear challenge, sort of first and foremost, presumably, with the levels that do kind of exist in that form in the first half of the game. And then, of course, there's the sort of rules and the characters' movement and all that kind of thing, which, again, you know, feels very much geared around a linear experience, and then you take it out into this open-ended sort of structure, and there is some awkwardness with that, as you know, you wouldn't necessarily, you know, I imagine, if you imagine such a thing, you think it might be awkward, and it is. I mean, I think that the primary sort of area of awkwardness is instant death pits. This is not something that one associates with you know, a Metroid-style game, but you still have them here, you know, right. Whereas, you know, I mean, I suppose there's Shantae games where that's true, that are quite exploratory,
yeah,
and they have later ones, you know, and they kind of mark them at least with like a little skull and crossbone sort of mist emanating from it to tell you there isn't another room down there, it's just death. which, in this case, if you consult the map, you can see that that's true, or just your memory of that area. But you know, there's no obvious, it's not as obvious visually as it would be in a case like Shantae. But in general,
it's not something you kind of get in these exploration-based games, things that just kill you instantly. Now, as I said last time, and this continues to be true in the second half of the game, there's plenty of checkpoints and things, so it's not necessarily going to be something that's going to, you know, throw you way back or whatever. But in a situation where you're just kind of exploring around, like it's not about surmounting the challenge, you just surmounting the challenge because you want to check something, some piece of the map, which, you know, opens up. You don't even have a map in the linear section of the game, whereas in the you know, the non-linear one, of course you do. But you would start to sort of look at, you know, what you had seen before in the linear run through, and so, okay, you know, where haven't I been, all this kind of stuff. And then you're just sort of going through sections to get to the bit you actually want to get to, your things that you've done before, and then, you know, you might die and then come back and all that. It is awkward, I think. It doesn't sit that well in a game of this type. I think it's an interesting thing, because they did show, you know, some of these kind of puzzle elements and the time travel elements, you know, the two different styles, 8-bit, 16-bit, all this. So it's not, you kind of feel like the second half of the game could have been almost like an inverted castle style, like twist, and like, oh, there's like a whole other half a game here type of thing. But it really isn't, because of the way they've handled the promotion. But I guess from that point of view, it's kind of a little bit like the inverted castle, in that, you know, that's just your copy and paste in the environment a second time to make the game bigger and then populating it with some new stuff. Here it's about kind of reusing certain aspects, as well as they can. And in general, you know, in some ways, it kind of works a little better than you might think. There is some clever ways they, kind of embedded things within levels that were kind of straight run-throughs originally and all this. So I don't want to sound like it's completely inartful or anything, but there's just a point at which, you know, it's not, you know, the fundamentals of the game don't, you know, if you were designing strictly an exploration game, they wouldn't be in there. You know, like I said, the aforementioned death pits and stuff like that, I don't see it myself. Or like the way the enemy spawn, I mentioned that last week. Again, you know, when you're in an exploration type game where you are going to double back more, that's more irritating, because right, you get more of that, I've killed it, oh, it's back again, you know, kind of thing. The character movement has the benefit of being very, very fast and agile and all that, so that kind of helps in the sense that you don't feel like you really, it's not like some of these things where, you know, if you could imagine, you know, a Castlevania game of this type, but you weren't Alucard, who's fast and agile, you were, you know, a Belmont, like that Circle of the Moon.
You were Steve.
It's a bit of like that. Is a little bit what Circle of the Moon is like, except you do have a dash in that game, but it also means you have to spam that dash like all the time to get anywhere at any kind of speed. But yeah, so the fact that the character mobility is so good, it works really well in the linear section, but it also is suited to the non-linear section, so that's good. And then you get the sort of introducing the element of the time shifting, which is, you know, familiar, I think, to any of us who have seen, you know, light world, dark world components in Zelda games, in Metroid Prime 2, the time shift stuff in Skyward Sword. It's pretty familiar stuff, but just, you know, I guess in a bit of a different context than you might have seen it before in this kind of action platformer setting. The sort of switching between the styles and the way the music changes and everything to reflect that is still, you know, an amusing thing to see, kind of pleasing to experience as you explore around these environments. So I think it does bring something to the table, and it's kind of, you know, specific to the second half of the game. And then there's just parts of the second half of the game that really are kind of standalone linear experiences, really, unto themselves, that almost could have been in the first half, that just happened to be in the second half, that help kind of break up the revisiting kind of components of it. And it doesn't, I mean, the map is pretty transparent about where, you know, there's extra rooms, you know, that split off from a particular area. Any kind of hidden, like, walls, for, you know, walls that are destructible, like Guillaume spoke about, you know, his sort of, you know, dislikes when it comes to this kind of game, where the walls, mm-hmm. the trick walls are just completely, like, indistinguishable from regular
ones.
You just
gotta swing your sword at each and every one of the tiles.
Yeah, any destructible walls in this it's visible. It's always visible. It might be a little bit obscured sometimes, like, you know, like you don't see all of the destructible bit, but if you look closely, you'll see. But it's always, there would never be any incentive to just swing at something that looks like regular wall. Because, gotcha. There will be a tell there. So in that sense, I think that's sensible, you know, given the nature of the game, that it's not going to be one of these really kind of old school, you know, like I said, the NES Metroid kind of era of ethos about it or anything like that. So I think there's some smart decisions made in the way they handle this sort of genre switcheroo that happens midway through the game. But I still probably just didn't enjoy the second half as much as the first half. And I think some of that is because I really do like as much as I love a lot of Castlevania games, I like the old school ones a hell of a lot. So, you know, as you might imagine, the sort of old school section of the linear section of this really appeals to me. I do like the classic Ninja Gaiden games too. But also, I think the one area in which this is sort of lacking as a Metroid style game is that you don't get that many sort of major ability upgrades in that section. Because you've been getting ability upgrades during the course of the linear part, your move set and ability set is largely fixed by the time you get to the second half of the game, which is not surprising for the second half of a game. But of course, because it only becomes open-ended at that halfway point, what you means is that whole process of, like, okay, I look around and then I find something and it opens something up and all that, there's not that much of that here in the messenger that actually revolves around using a cool new ability, which is to a large extent the essence of what's captivating about those sorts of games to me. A Metroid game, when you discover something, something like a screw attack that kind of not only lets you through a previously unbreakable barrier or whatever, but changes how you play the game, changes retraversal of areas you've been through before, all that kind of stuff. It just, there's not that much of that. And so you kind of find yourself looking forward to the bits which are more sort of linear, and they remain sort of well-crafted. It doesn't really kind of continue getting harder so much as well, as there's a fairly smooth upswing with the linear, half of the game, and then the second half is kind of seems to sort of stay at that point. It's not like, doesn't really feel like the bosses are getting trickier and trickier. There's still good stuff in there, but it's just, it doesn't feel like it's escalating. It just kind of feels like it's sidestepped, which it has, to a significant degree. So, I think what they've gone for here is, it's successful, ultimately. And some of the sort of trade-offs and stuff that are here, I guess, are just that's what they are. They're trade-offs. I don't think you can just, kind of surmount them by being super clever necessarily. Maybe they could have handled some of these things better. Maybe another thing that's sort of lacking from a kind of the ideal sort of notion of this kind of game, a Metroid-style game, is just those sections where retraversal becomes so much quicker because of an ability you get. Again, because your abilities kind of don't change that much, there's very little of that even though the core character movement is quick, so as I said last time, the mechanics are very tight, so it feels good. But in terms of, this is so much faster than it was in hour one, you don't get that kind of satisfaction that you might get in you know other games that play with similar mechanics, because it's just, again, it's too sort of rooted in the action, yeah, you know, the linear paradigm, I guess, with its level design. So it can't pull off the trick, you know, absolutely seamlessly and flawlessly, but I still enjoyed the second half of the game. I ended up getting all the sort of extra stuff, which are these sort of green medals that are, you know, very specifically in kind of rooms of their own, which are kind of sometimes a bit puzzly, always like some kind of, you know, feat of acrobatics and manipulating the game's mechanics have required. Some of them really rather tricky, but I enjoy doing them all. But it comes back to what we said about these games when I was talking about iconoclasts. Like, there's an issue of, like, okay, these ancillary pickups, how do we incentivize people? You know, is it missile tanks and energy tanks? Is it, you know, the sort of weird kind of perks that you had in iconoclast? Is it the weapons of Axiom Verge? Well, here it's these green medals, which you're just told that if you collect a load of them, you know, and immediately the number seems like, oh god, like that would take a long time to get when you just slowly get a handful during the early stages of the game. You will get something out of a chest, and immediately you're kind of thinking, is that all of them, you know? So are these kind of useless until I get all of them? And they are. And then what you get at the end is not particularly useful. So this might be one of the weakest attempts to actually incentivize or reward people for taking on these sort of ancillary challenges have these like quite clever level designs and you know sort of teasers within them, and they're fun. So again, as I've said before, it's really its own reward, but it's just, I do like to see incentive structures work a bit better than this, because it is so totally
work at all.
It is, yeah. So extraneous.
I don't think I mentioned it, but Yoku Island Express had the same problem. Like, there were a lot of secrets at the end after I beat the last boss, like to have 100% completion, and none of them were worth it. You know, like the,
yeah, like I said, it's a common problem with this kind of game. And I think it is always like, you know, do we really feel like we need all the health and ammo to go and beat Mother Brain in a Metroid game? Like, no, like they're rarely that hard. Like I said, do you need all the guns in Axiom Verge? I mean, I don't think you can even get all of them in one playthrough, because some of them are reserved for multiple playthroughs and stuff like that. I mean, it's always difficult to see how you can like really justify like all these kinds of additional objectives. That's to some extent why they're additional. But this is one of the most limp sort of attempts at that. For what are some really fun segments. I mean, getting these things is tough, and it's, you know, a lot of fun to take them on and get to the end and see how they've manipulated, you know, how they're asking you to manipulate your character's ability to get these things. But yeah, but that's the reward. It's just a sense of accomplishment for, you know, of actually, you know, experiencing the level design and getting that little thing. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't give you any, there is no broader payoff of much meaning to me, unless I'm missing something about the unlock that makes it way more useful than it's. But again, I'd kind of finished everything at that point, so what was I going to do with it anyway? Yeah, so there's that, and there was also a little bit of performance issues around when I was trying to get one of those extra medals, where there was a hell of a lot of stuff on screen, but it wasn't strictly that was the problem, because I think it was one of those situations where the game just needed to be reset. You know, like I'd been through there before, and there's a lot of stuff happening, and it was not affecting the performance of the game. But because I'd been playing continuously for some time, the performance just seemed to degrade until to the point that actually you really was, you know, affecting the timing and everything. And then you complete a reset and it was fine. So if you're playing this in short bursts, you probably never see this problem, and it may well get addressed in a subsequent patch or whatever. And it's certainly nothing that's particularly pervasive with the experience at all. But I thought it was worth mentioning that there might be the odd case of that if you're playing for extended periods. But overall, really thoroughly enjoyed the game. You know, I think it's a kind of a cool trick that it tries to pull off, and to the extent that it's successful in the second half, it is fun. But, you know, there's just some things that they couldn't quite surmount. And that's fine. You know, the fact that they tried something kind of ambitious and cool and didn't quite get it all the way correct. But, you know, it still feels kind of interesting and different as a result, while also being a very satisfying tribute to, you know, very familiar territory with stuff like Ninja Gaiden and Castlevania is pretty nice as a package.
So I am now sold on the Messenger, and I'm trying to not buy the Messenger as we talk. I'm just looking at it because I have enough to do. But beside stupid collectathons aside, high recommendation then, huh?
Oh yes, I think so. Like I said, I mean that stuff you can. I mean the fact that it's so. Sort of extraneous, it can be viewed as a positive. If you're not somebody that's all that you know, hell bent on tracking down every secret room with a secret challenge in it, you certainly shouldn't feel obliged to, because it's no real bearing on your ability to do other things in the game, or you know, make you powerful or anything like that. So yeah. If that's not your thing, just feel free to ignore it.
So
enjoy what's there in the, you know, the more linear aspects.
So instead, you've done a great service by alerting people who may not care to not bother.
I think, like I said, I think you can sense early on that, you know, that's probably how it's going to be. And for me, like I said, it's just a case of I wanted to do these challenges because they're cool. The challenges themselves are cool. The rewards are not.
I'm probably going to have to get the game just because it's made by French Canadians.
It is made by French Canadians.
That's how it goes, huh?
And I met them at E3. They are everything you would expect them to be.
Lumberjacks? Playing hockey?
Probably both at some point in their life, yeah.
Yeah, they seem cool. I think that one of them at least worked on Kona, a game that I talked about on this podcast.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and there's apparently, like in the language options, there's French and there's also Quebecois. So yeah, I gotta give that a shot.
I mean, because there's a pretty good amount of text in this game. You know, not so faithful to like 8-bit game. I know Ninja Gaiden was cinematic for its day, but it was still pretty terse.
Right. It had to be. Yeah, I've heard good things about the merchant in this game.
Yeah, this. I don't think I was as fond of the style and the humor as Neil was in his review, but it got me a few times. It got some chuckles out of me. It's not. I mean, it does feel a little bit like it's trying a bit hard, which reminded me a bit of Rive. In that way, but it's but it's purely text based, not nearly as obtrusive as Rive, and it actually made me smile more often than that as well. So yeah, I know, you know, other people might find it, and it's very very fourth wall breaking gags funnier than I did.
Cool. All right. Well, I have just finished my review of God War, so if you want to go read that, it is up at NWR, so I don't have to play that anymore. And I don't really have anything else to add. I more or less wrote it pretty soon after we recorded, I think maybe a day or two later, so there's not much to say there. In the interim, I picked up Yakuza 2 Kiwami. I'm not going to make you guys hear me talk about another Yakuza game. It's another one of these. It's using the Yakuza 6 engine, like which I said was a cool engine, so that's great. Instead, I have something that I was working on while I was delaying writing my review, because writing a review for a game that's that kind of just is actually pretty difficult. I am going to call this segment Memail, with M-E-M-A-I-L. It is a section where I wrote the email addressed to the lot of you, because this is important information that I want to extract from the three of you. Are you prepared?
No. Never.
Correct.
I'm actually playing Switch right now.
Good call. You have been hired by the board of Chemelle Pharmaceuticals to run J&J Dream Factory LLC. Following the recorded following a recording of the sole surviving Jay saying something unimaginably stupid during a probably intoxicated briefing to the staff about saying things that are not unimaginably stupid. As an aside, he is out publicly challenging the board. Anyway, the board has informed you that he has been bragging about some, quote, killer game ideas, but has refused to show them. Leafing through his desk, you found at least 11 bottles of gin, 6 Atari 7800s, and evidence that this man might be the only person still buying print pornography in 2018. On the bright side, you found at least a write-up of 3 pitches of dubious distinction. The board has demanded you leverage one of these into a game. Which are you throwing into production? Pitch number 1. Written on the back of an Egg McMuffin wrapper, it reads simply, Pokemon Go plus Max plus Math equals tax breaks. Scrawled in what you hope is maple syrup. Also the phrase, gym leaders, question mark.
What you hope is maple syrup. What would the other substance be that's...
Unclear, but not something that's not worth thinking about. Pitch number 2. It's over 11 pages long. Most of it looks like an inventory of Xbox original exclusive games. But he's highlighted random letters. After spending an eternity reading the literally between the lines of bangers like Bloodwake and Loon's The Fight for Fame, you manage to suss out that the highlighted letters spell Death Wish Soft Reboot Make My Video. Pitch number 3, Mr. J, again, not clear which J this is, keeping in mind J and J Dream Factory are not John and myself, has made what looks like a photo collage of an NFL quarterback, but it's been photocopied, so now it's black and white, tough to tell who, what team they're on. Amazingly, and potentially alarmingly, the paper has been stained by some kind of purple liquid. It's pretty clear he's inked some kind of deal, and the only part readable is licensed dog football game. So, your choices are Pokemon Go plus Math for tax breaks, a Death Wish reboot, Make My Video, or a football-themed dog game starring Jamarcus Russell.
I'm just going to go with Pokemon because Death Wish or football are not my thing. Also, you had me with the maple syrup, you know.
It's true.
It was not important enough for your final, you know, kind of summing up. But yeah, the back of the muffin wrapper was a nice touch.
Yep. John?
Death Wish, soft reboot, Make My Video.
You on board with that?
I'll only go with the Death Wish Make My Video if it is solely about making new Death Wish movies out of clips of the old ones.
That is exactly what it is about.
If that's it, if it's not reboot, like, you know, all different casts or anything, then I'm in.
It's a soft reboot, but using only original footage. And
well,
then public domain video.
No, Bronson, no sale.
Of course, Bronson.
Well, that's the thing, too, Greg. I'm thinking, what I'm thinking is you could have one with, like, you know, some extra DLC or exclusive DLC and call it the Extra Bronson Edition.
It's just Witcher sure is probably the same video, but it's not clear because those movies are basically all the same.
Speaking of taglines, one of the greatest taglines in cinema history, in my view, is Bronson is the only punishment. That's
very on the nose in ways they were not prepared.
It is so many ways. So many ways it can be applied.
So, yeah, it's got to be Death Wish.
See, John, I really expect you to go with some purple drink, so I'm a little disappointed.
No, I mean, I can't get enough Bronson. I don't know. It's in fact, when you read that, I was like, oh, this is kind of unfair to the other two. Because you know I'm going Death Wish.
You're saying that Jamarcus and Nidus dog football isn't going to be an exciting experience?
So are we saying experience? He's stolen Jerry Rice's dog, or he's just used the name?
I fully anticipate that Jamarcus Russell has stolen a dog at some point. Fair enough. For me, the choice is also Make My Video, but only because I want to cut Bronson in with, like, really bad chopped and screwed in public domain footage. Mm-hmm. I feel like all of that's necessary in my life.
I'm pretty sure Death Wish 4 is approaching that anyway, but I'll try and reach the bar that the Golan Globe has set.
I want to point out that 5 paragraphs of absolute stupidity was what I did instead of writing the review for God Wars, which is the most absolute condemnation of God Wars I could ever possibly muster. And on that, we're going to have real emails after the break. Stay tuned. Bye. We're back. listen amount of times you may send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please send us your questions, your comments, your theories, your inane ramblings about why your demonic circle for summoning Animal Crossing hasn't happened yet. Anything you got, just unload it into our inbox. Some of you already have. You know who you are. But, Guillaume, would you care to read our first email?
Sure. JX writes, "Dear RFN Super Team, congratulations. Following the inevitable bump of notoriety any character gets from appearing in Smash, you have been tasked by Nintendo to design a modern take on one of their noteworthy characters brought back into the public consciousness by several entries in the Smash Brothers series. Thus, how will you, individually or collectively, design the true 2018 experience for Mr. Game & Watch? Will it be a Switch game? Will it require specialized hardware? Will it include an alarm clock? I look forward to hearing your pitch."
Oh, no. All right, so we got to make a Game & Watch game. John, J&J Dream Factory's been contracted by ChemHealth Pharmaceuticals, Better Living Through Chemicals.
All right.
To make this game. This is our chance to get the Nintendo contract.
I would recommend, first thing that comes to mind is Labo, frying pan, sausages.
Like, cardboard. I like where your head's at, though. Mm-hmm. Cardboard's good, because cardboard's kind of 2D.
Yep.
And Game & Watch, this is... So do you make the frying pan?
Yeah, you would make it and also make the sausages. And then I guess the game would be, let me think about that. What would the game be? Would the game be to keep the sausages in the pan? I don't know.
Real life.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, it worked for Wii Music, right?
I don't even follow that one. I'm making like a really bad, like bad innuendo. You're like, "Wii Music, fuck it. I don't care. Conduct dog sounds."
Yeah. I don't know what game you would get out of that, but that's my first thing that I'm thinking. Maybe I haven't played enough Game & Watch in the last 30 years.
Who has?
Kind of think that Game & Watch, in all seriousness, would have been, if you had to bring it back, would have actually been a good vehicle for WarioWare. But obviously they chose Wario. In terms of, you know, he's in a bunch of different styles games because it was just like, okay, you know, he was this vague, you know, sort of amorphous character that was in all these different scenarios that Game & Watches threw up. Yeah, that's kind of perfect as the sort of backbone of the WarioWare concept of like, okay, well, now you're doing this, now you're doing that, now you're doing that, you know, kind of taking those little games and you're stringing them together in crazy sort of sequences and all that. But, you know, Nintendo chose otherwise, even though, you know, the Game & Watch things, you know, generally do feature in WarioWare games because they, you know, usually do celebrate, you know, a pretty wide sort of stretch of Nintendo history.
So I have spent far too long thinking about this email. Entirely too long. So I think there's two ways to go with this. One is
Bomberman Act Zero. That's always one way to go about this.
It's funny you mentioned Bomberman Act Zero because that was going to be one of my examples.
Of course it is. That's everyone's go-to for like, how could we bring something back by mutilating it horribly?
So there's the good example, like Bomberman Act Zero, where someone said, "Hey, this looks like shit. We should make it better." And then there's the bad one, which is everything else that's ever happened with Bomberman. So I'm thinking Mr. Game & Watch has a couple of defining features. One, the black and white aesthetic, because of course it was on the LCD screen.
Mm-hmm.
And two, his depth of emotion. So I'm thinking a character-driven story in 3D where Mr. Game & Watch walks through a daily life. Everything else is normal video except for him. Probably FMV, a guy in a suit. I think that really captures what Game & Watch is about, because think about the character. He's done... what was the Cuba Gooding Jr. movie that he actually won an Oscar for before he ruined the Oscars by doing Sled Dogs and the one where he pretended to be a gay man on a boat so he could get with the cruise director.
Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
There's the other one where he was the naval diver.
Oh, right. Yeah, with the... Oh, God, I do know this. Is it something to do with courage? I forget.
Yeah, it's something to do with courage. So, he's like, Mr. Game & Watch has done that.
Just thinking of Keith Courage, I'm sorry.
He's probably Keith Courage
in Alpha Zones.
There we go. Oh, God. There you got it. So, he's done that. He's been a chef. He saved people from fires. He's lived so many lives. Why don't we live through his eyes? VR experience.
To be fair, the live so many lives thing just made me think like a sort of Forrest Gump style tale just told entirely in silhouette.
That's it. So it's not told in silhouette though. Like I say, it's FMV, and it's, you know, those body suits, like they're all green that crazy people wear to sporting events. It's just that in black. Our actor playing Mr. Game & Watch is that in black. Doesn't talk, obviously, has no mouth.
He's just at a hockey game pressed against the plexiglass, like doing Game & Watch animations.
Yeah, exactly. He's going through his life, too. You know, he has a family and children. He has a job he's got to hold down. Like, he's got to pay bills. He's got a character-driven drama.
Yeah, that's really what I want to see. I want to see him, you know.
You want to see a meeting with his attorney to figure out if they can afford a divorce.
Yes. This is what I want to see. This sort of
slice of life stuff would feature alarm clocks. So that's that part of the question.
That's true. Alarm clocks, check.
I'm telling you, Mr. Game & Watch, she'll take everything.
Very first shot is his alarm going off. He's hungover, but he's got to get to work. He drinks so he can still feel.
It's Groundhog Day with Mr. Game & Watch.
Yeah.
Done. I VR, I think, is optional, but FMV absolutely isn't. Mm-hmm. Real actors definitely don't record the voice acting in the shot. Definitely overdub. That is always high quality. Top that, motherfuckers.
So all I'm going to say is if Game & Watch had been the star of the WarioWare series, that also would have featured alarm clocks.
You're right. It would have. In fact, it would have featured far too many alarm clocks.
Yeah, that would have been a lot of the stuff that comes out of the Gachapon machine. So, you know.
The phone stuff would have been weird, though, because when he answered, he wouldn't have been able to say anything.
I don't think I would change it, though. I think Wario works well for WarioWare for some bloody reason, I guess just because that was the R&D1's like mascot at that time when they invented the series, but it could easily have been a different character.
Guillaume?
I'm just reminded of Dr. Jonathan Metz's idea of a Game Boy Classic that would use e-ink screen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And okay. It just makes sense then for Nintendo, because there's been kind of, you know, I don't know, behind the scenes, like clearly Amazon was not pleased with Nintendo starting with the 3DS, I think, like something about returns of the units and stuff like that. So... since Amazon is very powerful and Nintendo maybe should placate them by offering their Game & Watch library on Kindle, you know, exclusively. And of course, Amazon...
The refresh rates don't matter, do they?
Not really. Yeah, and you don't need good controls. Like, those things have a touchscreen, so, you know, like, I think it would port fairly well to Kindle and...
to e-ink? Yeah. So what I will say is I long for the e-ink refresh rate of about one every half second, because that pretty well experiences some early Game Boy games.
Absolutely.
2 frames per second might be exorbitant for Super Mario Land, which is just a smear across your screen. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much authentic.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's like when you turn on the kind of... what are those called, the help features or whatever on Windows, and you give your mouse pointer a nice tail. So, it helps you keep track of Mario.
Imagine your mouse pointer is Alucard or, Samus in Metroid Fusion.
Yes.
Oh. Anybody else want to recast Game & Watch in a gritty reboot?
I mean, I think
reboot. It'd probably be like some sort of, you know, monochrome, sort of like Sin City looking visual novel.
The only color is red.
Yeah, exactly.
John, what you got?
I mean, I just think that definitely you have to go with something where you have that sort of the innocence of Mr. Game & Watch cast against the brutality of the world around him. So
are you saying like Mr. Game & Watch, minimum hourly wage life simulator? Is that what you're at?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking
like
you know,
the
maybe
Papers, Please of Mr. Game & Watch. You know, like, what are you doing?
Like, one of my favorite, you know, kind of game scenarios to move to is, let's take a character and let's age them about maybe 30 years. You know, they've been through some things.
Oh, he's got a freaking beard now. Everyone's got a beard. Jesus.
He does, but he's very grizzled. He's a grizzled Game & Watch now, you know? Mm. The game has kind of passed him by.
Grizzled Game & Watch!
The game has passed him by, and he is now literally watching his life fade in front of him.
So you're telling me he's just Grizzled Watch?
grizzled Game & Watch. And so now it's all he's doing is just really, the alarm is the time ticking off on his own pathetic life.
The whole Holy beard shit. Thing just reminds, now it makes me think maybe they should just give Game & Watch to Datemu, and, you know, to give, like, the Game & Watch games that Monster Boy makeover. It just makes sense.
It's HD visuals, over 10,000 colors, just gaming. All of them shades of black.
Yeah.
Yep.
The other thing is, we still, to this day, we don't know what Retro are doing.
It's true. And, they could be making Game & Watch.
You know, one of the most sort of memorable aspects
Game & Watch
of
Prime.
One of them. Hear me out. One of the most memorable aspects of their previous games, the DKC Returns and the Tropical Freeze games, is the silhouette levels. Game Watch had a cameo in the factory one. So, just do the math, right? First of all, buy a Jaguar, obviously. You're not doing the math if you're not buying a Jaguar. And second, the console, not a car. And secondly,
Why not both?
Both is fine. As long as the console is involved. And then, realize the obvious that is what Retro are working on, the Game & Watch hard-boiled detective side-scrolling platformer in silhouette.
I like that no matter how facile your argument, if you say do the math with enough emphasis, it becomes instantly believable. Do the math. Otherwise, you would make this argument would seem completely pointless. So if we can't do Game & Watch live action FMV, which I still think we can, I still think that's really the future of the Game & Watch brand.
Maybe a visual novel?
Yeah, you could do a visual novel. I'm thinking, what if we did a Game & Watch fashion-based game where you dress up Game & Watch? I'm thinking, like, all these costumes, they're all obviously authentic.
Is it, like, really heavily based around giving him 80s power shoulders?
I mean, I hope so.
I mean, he's effectively
could
naked,
actually
is
be
not?
Visible.
John just hit the nail on the head. Mr. Game & Watch is naked.
He's butt naked. I mean,
that's not true. He's wearing like a scaphander. Is that? Yeah. You know, like when in Octopus, he's wearing like the full scaphander thing. Is that
that's
a word?
Part of scavenger is the word you're looking for?
Scaphound. A diving bell. Jesus.
Yeah.
So he's got a
that
diving
is a word,
bell,
but
on.
Not in English.
Yeah,
right. But he's still naked though. He's just naked.
Yeah,
wearing.
That's part of his skin, Gil. That's he grew that. That's Mr. Game. That's the Aquaman version of Mr. Game & Watch. Yeah, that's part of his body.
But I mean, he's just a naked Game & Watch guy wearing a diving bell. I don't really want to know how it works. I'm cool.
Well, he puts it on his. Do you think diving bells don't work when you don't have pants?
I'm not saying.
I'm not gonna recommend it, but I'm gonna suppose they still work.
Yeah, that's what I know. I mean, the guy's not wearing pants. I mean, now how offensive it is the fact that he's not wearing pants? I don't know.
But we can make it better. We can give him pants. Mm-hmm. We can design pants for him, but only in a single color.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying there is huge, like Animal Crossing's huge. You design clothes not all the time. What if you could only design solid black clothes, just for Mr. Game & Watch. Animal Crossing Game & Watch is what I'm saying.
Animal Crossing Jerry Glanville Edition.
And that's like football reference six today, so we're going to move right on to the next email. John, would you please?
Sure. Paul writes, Hi, RFN crew. With the same day release of Into the Breach on Switch, I'm left wondering if a splashy second wave release strategy for the indies on Nintendo Switch may be appealing to developers who see a perverse set of incentives lining up between games coverage and the Nintendo Switch. We've seen new life breathed into Hollow Knight, Stardew Valley, Overcooked, Shovel Knight, and many others since the launch of Switch. While none of these could have taken advantage of a delayed rollout on Switch, given they were developed before the birth of the console, developers making new games may see these successes and think to themselves, what if we launch on some non-Switch platforms first, maybe a timed exclusive on Xbox to fund the game, then time a Switch release to meet demand for that sweet portable version to open some window. To some open window. Reliably, Switch releases of acclaimed games garner a lot of renewed attention from games media. Some people may learn of the game for the first time through the second wave of publicity. Others who, quote-unquote, missed the game may opt to jump in on Switch or even buy on the original platform due to the zeitgeist's strong pull. And diehard fans of or Lindemans may just scoop it up on the new platform because, branded click sound, Switch. Where are the flaws in my genius two-phase rollout strategy? I'm sure you can find many with all the business that RFN gets up to. Keep up the great work. More Sarin and more NWR chat.
Absolutely not.
Definitely combined as well. I'd like to think that John would host and then Sarin would speak and then the show would end.
Yep. Kind of like me putting them out there and Sarin back and clean up. So.
But see, here's the thing. So I can be completely not responsible for that mess. Like, I can come back.
Oh, yeah. We're offering you absolution, James. I don't know why you're so tight, you're penned up about it.
Because I'm trying to, like, so imagine I lent someone my house for, like, a week. Well, I'm gonna be out of town. Like, hey, can you house sit for me? And they just fucking burn the place down. Mm-hmm. Deliberately. Like, they're like, I'm gonna get the fireplace going and then roast hot dogs in the fireplace. And they forget I have a gas fireplace. And they just fucking set the place on fire. I'm still responsible because I let that idiot run the house. If I let John run the house and then set him up for failure like this, who's really responsible?
I mean, at worst, James, it would be some sort of Weekend at Bernie's scenario where I'm dead and she pulls me around all over the place.
Point?
Yes.
Your starting point is an actual
death? I'm just going right to the. I'm just going right to worst case. Weekend at Bernie's was entertaining. This would be entertaining.
Was it, John? It kind of has one joke that wears out like 10 minutes in, and then there's a second one for some reason. And they
Weekend
go to the beach in that one.
At Lindy's. Just think about it. It wouldn't be that bad.
Did you really need to name my untitled Game & Watch project? I thought we had an agreement here.
All bets are off.
The fuck was this email about again?
I don't even know. The email is about developers releasing their games on other platforms,
right,
and then timing and then releasing them later on Switch so that they get maximum publicity.
Hollow Knight's a weird example here though, because it had never come out on a console before. Into the Breach is the same way, right? They're console first on Switch. They
right.
had it on PC previously.
Yeah, and that's a lot of games, right, that are just come out on Steam first, and then the consoles are rolled out.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm kind of surprised that the Switch is getting that many kind of console exclusives, like as many as it is. So,
this week was bad about, like, the, hey, it's just shit that came out on other systems before. This week, for whatever reason, had a ton of, like, 2 or 3 year old indie games.
Right, but games that came out before the Switch was even announced.
Right.
Yeah.
Like stuff that was just super, but most of the stuff in the last few weeks has been like, hey, this is coming out first in consoles into the Switch space. I think part of the reason they're already out on PC is that's where the game, like, you can release on PC in a much less finished state than on console.
Yeah.
And that's where a platform holder like Nintendo sees the game and goes, hey, we want this on our system first. And we'll go make the deal to make that happen. So it comes out on PC because PC's where it's easiest to get a game out. And then from there, it springs into a larger discussion. I saw a tweet. So Untitled Duck Game was sort of, or Goose Game, excuse me, was sort of like the big pop moment in the last Nintendo Direct.
With the indies presentation.
Yeah, not counting the one that got postponed for today, obviously. That was sort of like the big zeitgeist pop out of that one, because that game, like, immediately you start thinking about, like, oh, this is a game where you get to just play an Agent of Chaos. That's fun. One of the people making that game basically posted, or one of the people publishing that game posted a screenshot of an email they sent when they saw a video of this game from this PC time that basically was just sent to the developer going, like, so you guys need a publisher? Like, visibility happens where visibility is a prelude to getting, like, console dev kits, and PC is really the only place you can make your game then, effectively.
No, I mean, I wonder to what extent this email was at all kind of prompted by the situation with Cosmic Star Heroine. You know, where, was it Robert Boyd, is it, that... kind of express some displeasure with how the launch went on Switch in terms of it not getting as much push on the storefronts and whatnot. But the interesting part about that is, I guess somebody said, I think he was quoted somewhere saying that it got an all right number of reviews, which kind of goes to the point that's being made in this email about the fact that, you know, that if you release it in this two-phase strategy, as it's referred to by Paul here, the idea that you kind of spike the reviews again, you know, so that for the console-specific stuff. And I guess, you know, the Cosmic Star Heroine example is one where I guess that was not one of his bigger grievances. You know, we reviewed it, of course. Other sites reviewed the Switch version specifically, even though I'm sure a number of them had reviews on file for the game on other formats, but at the same time, I think it was still about eight, I think, in sort of the launch, you know, period for the game on Switch. So it's not the biggest kind of juicing up of coverage again.
No, and I don't know. Like, I know we had one.
Yeah, oh, I just said that. Yeah,
but I don't know. I don't. Well, it says I don't know, like, where we got our review copy relative to when the game came out. Because that is something that can make it difficult to get coverage out there. If you get a review code for a game that's kind of long, you know, 4 days before the game comes out, like,
So I mean, that's the, in the case of, like I said, of Robert Boyd and you know, his complaints, it was really about the amount of publicity. Now, I guess that's the interesting component of this, is what influences what gets pushed. If this sort of phase strategy is to be successful, at least according to kind of you know, some of the things that Boyd said, you know, presumably you've got to get a bit of push on the eShop from Nintendo because there's so much stuff coming out. So the question is, if you're not like a catalog game, a highly acclaimed game that came out, you know, well before the Switch did, that's getting coming to Switch now. Yeah, you're Undertales, you're Gone Homes, I guess, yeah, this sort of stuff. But you're instead sort of by design in Paul's construction coming out, you know, on one console before the Switch and then Switch later to kind of you know, sort of gin up interest twice and hit the portable kind of market second, I guess. How accommodating or helpful are Nintendo going to be in that scenario? And I guess you could say maybe the experience of Cosmic Star Heroine doesn't speak that well to how that would go, but we don't really know all the factors that went into that, or whether it's just a case of, well, you know, not everything could get spotlighted by definition. So, right. You know, the just... certainly, you know, from that perspective, you'd have to say this sort of strategy comes with it a certain risk that, you know, what you think is going to be kind of creating a spike in interest, you know, multiple sort of points of interest for your game in the kind of public discourse might in fact simply be diminishing it in the first case. And then, you know, there's no real successful trade-off of that later, because if it doesn't get pushed on the eShop, it becomes, you know, it gets a handful of reviews or whatever from Nintendo-specific sites, perhaps, and a few general sites, and then passes by largely unnoticed in a wave of other games coming out that are newer.
Right, and Nintendo's really... the sort of back catalog games, Nintendo's really only pushing them when they add something for Switch, or conversely, if there's like another game coming out that's related to it, like roughly the same time. I think even like really acclaimed games like Bastion, and I can't remember the other game they're making, that they made, rather.
Oh,
I can't remember, but the people who made Bastion, like they have two of their back catalogs coming to Switch. They got a very, very brief like sizzle reel mention. That's it. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, that it might even represent some kind of like fairly significant conversation that had to happen to even get that. A lot of what Nintendo features, though, are things that are coming to them first, or are of particular interest to their audience, or are getting some kind of exclusive content when they finally do show up.
Transistor,
that's it. Other stuff, just like Towerfall got a fairly quick mention. And that's got some new content in it based on another popular indie game that's come out on Switch. Like there's
Celestia.
There's like always a thing that they throw in there on top of it. So if you have a thing that you think might pique Nintendo's attention, then that might be fine. Like you might be able to say like, okay, I could deal with this. But otherwise.
But still, I guess there's the question of, how productive you expect that relationship to be, if this seems to be like a repeat model. How kind of repeatable is it? If it's like, okay, every time, it's a case of, well, you've already done something where it's temporarily exclusive to a different console, and then you come to us and have a some sort of twist on it. I'm not sure how sustainable that would be in practice. Maybe you could pull it off on singular occasions. Although it'd probably have to be where there's a perceived match with the Switch, Nintendo kind of fan base, user base, kind of thing. But I'm not sure it would constitute a model exactly. That it would be that applicable.
Yeah, I mean it's. The games they pushed that are coming late this time were games that people always thought, like, that should be on Switch, like Samurai Gun or Towerfall. Like, these games should be on Switch because, like, oh my god, they're four-player games that you could play with the Joy-Con. They're party games that really sort of drive to what Nintendo's push has been on Switch. Or they're games that are coming... pretty much it was either that or games that are coming to them first, like Maneko's Nightmare. Which is also coming to PC at roughly the same time. Everything they show right now is stuff that really speaks to their audience. Like, that's what they're pushing. And you get one push. That's it. So, Murphy's Law, for example, which took for fucking ever to come out, got its one push. And Nintendo basically never talked about it again, even when it came out. Like, it. In case you missed it, it came out. It was kind of middling. Like, it exists, and so what? But like you get your one shot at it, and if you hit it, like if your game is ready when Nintendo talks about it and it's out there in the next week or two, then you might be able to deliver. But I think that's the other part. When Nintendo, if you get that PR boost from them, you need to do it when your game is ready, not
or at least you get a release your first-person shooter, competitive first-person shooter before Fortnite comes out on Switch.
That's a concern. But just that, like, the it's available now slot is probably super lucrative if you have like a really enticing-looking game, because you can get people impulse buying who have been ginned up by a direct. Like, they've been fed just enough red meat that they're ready to go. They're ready to open their wallet.
And yeah, I think that's where the sweet spot might well be, that it has already been out on PC, perhaps, where in it's got that kind of appeal of that it's come to a console for the first time, and you've got that sort of buzz of like, oh, and it's available now. But there's some pre-existing sentiment out there to sort of justify an impulse buy. You know, with Hollow Knight, right. for instance, at E3, that was a sort of a welcomed announcement because there was a reputation surrounding the game already that was very much reinforced by all the coverage that then followed. But certainly in driving that first wave of impulse buys, the fact that it already had a reputation of how good the game was helped in that respect. So that kind of element of the two phase, I think, is kind of helpful. What Paul's talking about can be helpful. What Paul's talking about, but maybe it is the sweeter spot, especially in terms of working with Nintendo and doing this on a repeat basis. Actually, having it as like a model is more PC and then Switch rather than a different console exclusivity.
It really helps. I know just because of the way it's so hard to find out whether or not a game is good or not on the eShop. It really does help if I have PC reviews to refer to for it.
Right. Like, this game isn't out yet on Switch. Should I be excited? It looked cool in this video. Should I be excited for it, or is it just kind of eh?
Yeah.
I would say the other thing, and with the exception of, like, I haven't played Murphy's Law, but people I talked to have said, like, eh, it's fine. Basically, Nintendo's done a pretty good job picking bangers to show off. Mm-hmm. They showed off Dead Cells a little bit, right? But not much. But it's still doing really well. Even though it's been on PS4 for a bit. I want to say, someone reported 4-to-1 sales. Like, there is a certain amount of these things just kind of sell well on this platform, because if you have both to choose from, people tend to want to, if a lot of these games, pick the Switch because they get to play it on the go.
Yep,
and when I say on the go, a lot of times it seems to just mean like other places in their house.
Yeah, no, it's not literally just flights or around someone else's house, or it can just be being untethered from one particular place or hogging the TV and all that, which Wii U had going for it a little bit, but I think Switch is really kind of realizing that kind of appeal in a way that I think the confusion around Wii U's what it actually was never really could.
I'm just remembering wistfully the days when, and it's available now, referred to like virtual console games, like on 3DS.
To what? What are you talking about?
Well, wasn't Earthbound made available, or like Earthbound Zero made available during E3?
Well, yeah. I'm curious what this virtual console thing is you're talking about.
Sorry. It was this old thing on the 3DS and the Wii U.
It was this old thing selling old things.
Yeah.
Older things.
What was the other game that came out? Like, it was something weird. Was it a Zelda game? Like,
Four Swords was that.
Huh. Okay.
But, well, the DSi.
Yeah, that was a DSi thing. Yeah.
Right. Right.
That was during the Zelda 25th.
I guess, when they first did Game Boy Virtual Console, when that was back at an E3 on 3DS, wasn't that like Super Mario Land and Link's Awakening DX? So,
I think you're right. Yes, I think that's what I was thinking of.
So that launched the day before the eShop launched like the day before their briefing. Because we had to try to download the eShop patch for our 3DSs in the hotel.
Oh, yeah.
And that was
didn't
not
work.
Good.
No.
I downloaded it at the show floor because the internet was better at the LACC than in the hotel, which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember that whole fiasco because we were trying to do coverage of it, the away team was. T-minus 9 hours to E3 exploding all over us, which is probably the dumbest decision that I've made covering the site, but that's fine. I don't think there's any like guaranteed path to success. Like I get, Robert Boyd's frustration. It is by all intents a good game. It didn't seem to click the right boxes to get it not just Nintendo's attention, but the attention of everybody else.
And that
was especially
compound.
That was the month that Octopath Traveler, the million seller Octopath Traveler came out. It's like, well,
yeah, and it was a compound frustration, I think, because of the fact that it'd taken so much time and time, you know, that it needn't have from Boyd's point of view to get the game on Switch, because they haven't been very accommodating with getting him development kit resources and all that kind of thing, and then a contractor offers it to port it for him and all that, and he gets there eventually, and then by the time it gets there, it's going up against a much better publicized like RPG nostalgia product that sells really well. It must be a compound frustration to him, I'm sure.
Sure. There are other games where you hear like this, the Switch version is killing it, and you go like, okay, why though? Like, how did we get here? Why is this game blowing? I think it's just the audience is there, and there's not a ton of like super big games coming out for Switch right now, but there is a ton of these smaller games, and unlike the other two platform holders, Nintendo actually spends time talking about them. I mean, John, you had said, speaking of corrections from the Resetera thread, I pointed that you and I are the only crazy people who own everything right now. Mm-hmm. How often does Sony talk about indie games? Ugh. Ever?
They don't really. Not a lot.
They did during the Vita time, because that was what they had on it. Microsoft has ID at Xbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so they talk about it. They talk about it some.
Yep. They also they'll have like indie month or whatever. Right.
They reserve it for like specialized times.
Yeah.
So if they're doing a big press conference, they'll always devote some time to ID at Xbox. They'll tweet about it on Twitter every so often, but even their efforts not nearly as concerted or constant. Like there is a constant. I mean, we talked about it last week. Nintendo in two consecutive weeks, two consecutive regions, did two consecutive, completely different stylings of indie game video drops.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Direct hadn't been postponed because of the earthquake, which, again, terrible, awful, there probably would have been indie games in that too. Almost certainly. They are beating that drum, but. As you said, there's a million games coming out on this damn thing, and it's going to be hard to stand. We hear about the successes because they're talking about it, but there was that. I doubt that everything gets like the stuff that doesn't succeed probably doesn't get talked about. I can't imagine those digital love games are selling super great.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, because they're not even in English, and also they're creepy. But like, they're out there too, just. Probably not selling.
Yeah, I mean, there gets to a point when so much stuff is coming out that not everything is going to be a home run. Like, that, you have that gold rush scenario only for so long.
Right. Eventually, people start, they don't hit gold veins anymore. They're just losing it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, to that point, though, there's been some games that have just fucking killed it. Celeste, Hollow Knight, Stardew Valley, Blossom Tale, I think Owlboy did really well. You know, I mean, it's out there. Like, I don't think holding on to your game and then releasing it a few months later is a smart decision. I know there was some talk that, and that didn't happen, so I know there was some talk that Battle Chef Brigade kind of underperformed. But not just on Switch, just sort of in general. Like, it was in the middle of what they wanted. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that holding is going to be super successful. I mean, Shovel Knight came out on Wii U first and sold super great on fucking Wii U. So, like...
Yeah, that's a case of the power of the audience match there. Yeah. Because, you know, the user base and the kind of general awareness is not really going in your favor necessarily, but reviews and just the match with the people's tastes on that platform did.
Right.
And so, yeah, with Switch you're getting that, but then they've got some wind in the sails as well in terms of actually having some buzz around the platform in addition to that.
Yeah, like Overcooked did really well because it fits the platform, and Overcooked 2 is first on Switch. Again, it fits the platform, so I would assume Nintendo went out and made sure it happened. Yeah, man, I think some of it's going to be just dumb luck. I don't know that holding... I don't think Slice, Dice, and Rice coming out now, like 2 years later, is going to help that game out. Ever. Oh, man, I remember that weird fighting game.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that you would really want to get everything out of. I mean, you would always want a worldwide launch, theoretically, right, on everything.
Across all platforms, yeah. Because you get to maximize your boom.
Yep. And also, you know, that way you can, you would also maximize your marketing spend if you want to get real businessy right. about it.
But if you can only make one, you're going to go after PC because you don't have to buy an expensive dev kit.
Exactly. Yep. And you can also tweak it a lot more, do patches more, you know, more quickly and all that
and
stuff.
And PC owners are used to getting games that aren't done.
Yeah.
Steam has made this like alarmingly acceptable in some ways.
Yeah.
And so from there, then you can build out a finished product and maybe you can line up a publisher or you can get some cash flow going and you can look into getting a dev kit. And then you got to figure out what your market match is. If you can't do all three, you know, where should you be right now for what you are putting out? And, you know, if you're making a four-player action-y game that is simple, then Switch is probably a pretty good bet. Businessman. John, are you going to get ACA Neo Geo Football Frenzy?
No, I'm not going to get Football Frenzy, but, you know, they have the Neo Geo Mini coming out, which is kind of neat. I haven't looked at what games are in it, but
after the Neo Geo Gold, I'm like eternally doubtful.
Yeah, I feel like a Neo Geo Mini is sort of it goes against everything that Neo Geo is about because Neo Geo is about a big
it's
honk.
About gigantic.
It's macro. About a big honking console. It's macro, exactly. A big honking console with big honking cartridges.
I want the Neo Geo Mini to be the size of like a pizza box.
Exactly.
And they're like, it's technically smaller than the previous one.
Yep. It's thinner. It's thinner than the other one, but it takes up the same amount of carbon. It has the same carbon footprint.
Yeah, it's just like a little system on a chip. It's like a, you know, it's like the size of a pack of mints, but they just put like sand in the box to maintain the weight. So you just hear the sand sloshing around.
Mm-hmm. You open it up and there's like an Xbox One inside of it, and then inside the Xbox One is actually the Neo Geo chips.
So why does this thing weigh so much? Oh, we wanted to keep it authentic.
You ask Phil Spencer.
They just made the Neo Geo Mini out of metal and then plasticized the outside so you wouldn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just iron. It's highly magnetic.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's dumb enough to end the show for us. You can send your emails to... That was third email, right? Yeah, that was third. Just want to make sure I didn't miss an email.
It was a second email.
No, that was only the second.
You're right. Yep. I was like, what am I doing? All right, third email. I apologize. I'm sorry. I'm very tired. Greg.
Yes, Anna writes, with the announcement of Diablo 3 coming to Switch, do you think it's possible that StarCraft 2 could make its way to the console eventually? After reading the interview with producer Pete Stillwell from Blizzard, he stated the core gameplay aspects would have to be immensely changed to even work. With that said, do you think they could take cues from Pikmin and use the motion aiming of the Joy-Con, create a snappy play control mechanism that could work fairly well with StarCraft 2's gameplay?
Yeah, I think it would be a long shot. I mean, I just think of like Halo Wars 1 and 2.
Hawa.
Yeah, and they're not bad to play, but you run into weird stuff like trying to survey the entire game field quickly with console controls is kind of weird. Again, doable, but kind of weird. I just think that StarCraft 2, it plays so fast that I just don't think it would really translate that well to a console.
Yeah, and Diablo 3, I played a little bit of it on PlayStation 3. I'm having a hard time remembering exactly what the control scheme is, but it's it works well with a controller because you're controlling one character. And I think that probably like a skill was assigned to each of the face buttons. You know, you've got like probably a potion for health, like mapped to the shoulder buttons. Like basically, you got plenty of buttons to do what you want to do. But StarCraft, like you want to be able to call up like this kind of squad that you have posted somewhere. You want to be able to select them quickly. You want to have a shortcut, you know, for that. You want to have shortcuts for each of their actions. You've got different types of units. They've all got
mouse and their keyboard.
Own, yeah, they've all got their own special actions, and that you know, it would be extremely, extremely challenging, I think, to try to make that make sense on a controller.
I can give you some practical experience here, because I played Star Fox 64. And yeah.
I'm pretty sure we all have. But have you played the StarCraft?
Sorry, you're right. StarCraft 64. Jesus Christ. told you I'm tired. they actually mention it in the interview that they don't want to go back through another one of those again. And like, yeah, it's incredibly. I had played it on PC and beaten it in Brood Wars. I don't know, 3 or 4 times. So I don't even know why I bought it on the N64. I guess the novelty of it. Like, I wanted to have this game on a cartridge on my TV. And like, yeah, it was a pretty significant loss in terms of like my ability to respond to things on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And not even necessarily because of key bindings. I was a dumb kid. I didn't have a bunch of key bindings and like set up command groups and stuff like that. Just the ability to scroll around fast was a pretty, and like with fidelity and click drag and stuff like that was a pretty big bummer losing that.
Yep.
And to be honest, like, I don't know that they really want to go back into StarCraft II land. You know what I mean? Like, do they really want to get back in there and make another version of StarCraft II right now?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it kind of had a rougher launch than they thought it would, I think. I mean, like, originally StarCraft II was supposed to be one game, and then it became 3 games. They were like, well, this is too ambitious, and we got to split this into 3 parts. And then I think they were hoping to have more of an esport kind of thing than they ended up having. It seems like people had moved on from RTS to MOBAs, and
which came out of their game,
or ironically just stuck with StarCraft, and so then they went back and they updated the original StarCraft and keep updating it today, because that fan base never went away. So
right, it's a different it's a different market than when StarCraft II came out in a different market than the market they started developing it in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a bad situation to be in a lot of the time. And I don't, the difference between StarCraft and Diablo 3 here, obviously, is that they've already made a consoleized Diablo 3.
But also, when I first played Diablo 3 on PC, I said, almost immediately, I said, why is this not a console game? Because it really only has, it requires maybe 5 buttons, maybe 6, 7 buttons, and that's it. Like, there was nothing on there that you could not map directly to a controller and have buttons left over.
Right. It worked better, and they've already done it as a consequence of that. Mm-hmm. Like, in theory, you would probably hear people say that Overwatch works better on a mouse and keyboard. It does on a gamepad, but they have a solution for it that works, and they've already kind of tread that ground, so it's okay to put out console versions of it.
Yeah.
In fact, they did it because that was where there was money to be made.
And I mean, it's not even that the controls aren't even as complex as Fortnite's. So
no, exactly. But this is just so hard.
Yeah, there's like, yeah,
you could do cursor controls with the Joy-Con.
Yeah, you got a lot more options than they had when they was doing StarCraft 64. I think that's clear, but it's still a heavy lift, seemingly. I mean, because they talk with Diablo as well, like they're not interested in using the touch on the Switch for that.
Right.
And obviously it's a bit tricky that in general, because then you're creating a kind of separation between the portable and the docked play, which you can kind of get around a bit with the Joy-Con. Kind of like with the Okami HD port, you've got touch control on that, but you've also got the kind of pointer style, even though it's not literally an IR pointer the way it was on the Wii version for Okami and stuff. But so you have got some options there, but it still seems like it would be some real heavy lifting to even get to a place that could work. And then I think what comes into play is what James talked about in terms of how much do you want to make it work, and do the economics of that line up.
So the question just comes down to, do I think I'll see it? No. You guys?
No. No, absolutely not. I think
unless it comes out with a Labo controller, kind of a
make your own mouse and keyboard.
Cardboard. Yeah, exactly. then maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would do something like Hearthstone long before they would ever touch anything like StarCraft.
How the fuck is Hearthstone not out yet?
I don't understand that. I've never understood that. But
is Hearthstone on the other consoles?
No, it's not.
Okay.
But I mean, it would be perfect for Switch, though. Right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. Even if it was only touchscreen mode.
Yeah, I mean, it would be perfect for it. I mean, even more so than, you know, I mean, they have stuff like Gwent from like the Witcher card game. I mean, that's like out on Xbox One and PS4 and like whatever. So I have no idea why Hearthstone isn't, you know, out there too.
I don't know. It's on mobile though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So I don't know. It's free to play game. Maybe it's that there was still some like struggle with free to play games on the closed systems, but after you know where we're at now with things like Fortnite, I can't imagine it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah.
But okay, well, that will definitely do it for our show this week. There wasn't some type of veiled attempt to close it a few minutes ago. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please do. We are ready and waiting for your questions, ideas, crazy theories, fever dreams. You send them. We'll read them. Not necessarily on the show. We'll definitely read them. Please use that power responsibly. Greg.
Yes.
What do we have for closing music this week?
Well, my original plan was to see what the Direct would inspire. And of course, that did not come to pass. And so I thought I'd go with something that I wouldn't have imagined would be used as closing music for the show, because it's kind of too ambient and all that, but I thought it was kind of appropriate in the absence of the Direct and for the reason that it was delayed, which is the tragic events in Hokkaido in Japan. And as we record this, you know, a number of people have lost their lives, many more are missing, all that sort of thing. So, I mean, you completely understand Nintendo's process, and it's it truly is a tragedy. This song from the Legend of Zelda: The Wind Waker is used in the kind of like lesser kind of dungeons and caves, and it's pretty much a not particularly different reworking of the Deku Tree dungeon theme from Ocarina of Time, but somehow, even though it's only a little different, it takes on a really different, really quite starkly different quality as a result. It's very somber, but at the same time very tranquil and relaxing. So I've always found it good for a time of kind of reflection. If there's something going on that really makes you stop and think about things, as I think this does. So I thought it would be appropriate for something a bit off the beaten track as far as closing music goes. And we probably only have a brief loop of it here, but it's the kind of thing that's pretty, you know, it's pretty good to help you get to sleep or just relax for a while, because like I say, it might be somber, but it's very very soothing as well. It's a strange mix. You'll see all of these things in this music the way I do after saying all that.
All right, well, that's good to do it for us. Bye, everybody.
Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.